STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Gosh, just stop it. Greg tries to make me laughing. Of course, he's successful, but it's just gross. It's just little boy humor. So just stop it. This is STR Asks. Yeah. We're supposed to be professionals. This is STR Asks for Stand to Reason. Hashtag STR Ask. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with little boy Greg Kokel.
What was your first name?
Melinda the Enforcer. What did I say? Anyways, so here we are starting the second episode this week. 20 minutes. Greg has 4 minutes to answer questions. Mm. New episodes posted Monday and Thursday. Yep, just checking all my notes. Anything else I need to announce? Anything you have to say right now?
Well, we've got a birthday coming up.
Stand to Reasons?
Yeah.
Yep, we do next week. Our 23rd anniversary.
Well, will it?
We do not say we're beginning our 24th year. You do not get credit for 24 years till you reach 24 years. We're celebrating 23 years. And that's good. You don't have to borrow credit on next year. So, I mean, if anybody doesn't know, this is one of my many pet peeves with Greg. He likes to mark anniversaries by saying the year you're starting. We're starting our 24th year.
All right. Well,
nobody on their birthday says I'm starting my 67th year, which is what you would say on this kind of birthday.
I only have one thing to say to that.
Anyways, okay. Send us your questions on Twitter using hashtag STRAsk. That's where we get the questions, and Greg gets 4 minutes to answer them. So let's go. First question comes from Jason Duell. What's the biblical basis for thinking people go to hell immediately at death rather than at the white throne of judgment?
Well, hell is a very general word. And
why does that surprise you? We've been doing it from the very beginning.
I know. I always like to lick at Brooke's face every time I pause there and look at her for clicking me like that, for ticking me like that or whatever. Hell is a general word. It's translated from, I think, different Greek words. One, for example, Gehenna and the like, or maybe Sheol, which is the place of the abode of the dead or whatever. The point is that we think of hell as the final disposition of the unrighteous. And, there is a final disposition. You read about it in the book of Revelation, and that's when the devil and the prophet and the beast, the unholy trinity, are all tossed in there. This is their final disposition, their final punishment. And then it says, anyone whose name is not written in the book of life is also thrown into the lake of fire. So you could say, strictly speaking, if that's hell, then no one goes to hell until after the Great White Throne Judgment. But where they go in between is no fun either, okay? And when Jesus gives, it's not clear whether it's a parable or an account or an illustration or whatever, but he talks about the rich man and Lazarus. It's he talks about a rich man who is in Hades, I guess, or he's in torment. Okay, wherever he's dead, he's gone. That's it for him, and he's in torment. But it isn't the final hell. And the believer, Lazarus, is in the bosom of Abraham, so he's receiving comfort. And so I think there are a couple of things that Jesus means to communicate in this parable, and again, you can't, it's not, it doesn't look like you can take everything strictly literally, but the general thing is that wherever that place is that you go before you go into the final place, it's still pretty nasty. It's torment. And so I think of it kind of like a county jail before you go to the state pen. So let's say you're convicted of a crime, or you are accused of a crime, and you're probably guilty. So you hole up in the county jail for a while. Then you get tried. Then you're guilty. Then you go on to the final disposition.
I don't know. Twin Towers in L.A. is pretty horrible.
Yeah, it is pretty horrible. I agree. Some county jails are better than others. You don't want to go to L.A. But the point, this is pretty horrible. Whatever that temporary place is before the final judicial act is accomplished there in Revelation 20, it's not any fun. And so I would count as my biblical basis the thing that Jesus taught about the rich man and Lazarus.
Okay, good. I was just thinking, because the person who wrote this, as is common, put hell in lowercase. Our style sheet here at SDR, and this is my little soapbox, I guess, it's capitalize heaven and hell, because these are real places, just as real as Seattle and Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So,
well, when you
use them, capitalize heaven and hell.
Well, yeah, that's good. That's a good point when they're being used as proper nouns, like the place called heaven and the place called hell,
like people who go to hell.
Or, we've had a hell of a good time.
Well, of course not that.
Or hell no.
That's a title, so of course you're going to capitalize it.
But when you go to hell.
Okay. So next question comes from Abate 16. We can still use imprecatory psalms, right? So I think she's talking about never read a Bible verse. We don't take things out of their historical context and naturally apply it to our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what about imprecatory psalms?
Well, these psalms are the psalms that are kind of the...
Did I pronounce that right, by the way?
Imprecatory is the way I would say it.
Imprecatory, okay.
Wasn't going to correct you in public, but yeah, you got it wrong. Imprecatory is the way I've heard it pronounced. In any event, these are the psalms where David gets really mad and says really nasty things like, I would that they would dash their babies on the rocks and stuff like that. And you have some others.
See, those make me really uncomfortable.
What, that you mispronounced imprecatory?
No, that kind of...
Language is used.
That kind of anger and viciousness towards other people is used. And I know I've read, that it's getting angry on behalf of God and, God's offense is a good thing. But some of these... It just seems they're not necessarily God's enemies. They're David's enemies. And it seems like he really wants them to get punished.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interpretive issue, mm-hmm. And so there are psalms like that where David's just unloading and he says this stuff. There are other psalms, though, like Psalm 5, for example, where David is talking almost from God's perspective. He says... You are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness. No evil dwells with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do iniquity. You destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the man of bloodshed and deceit. That's Psalm 5. We see something similar in Psalm 11. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. That is, God's soul hates. And on the wicked, he will rain snares, fire and brimstone, burning wind will be the portion of their cup, for the Lord is righteous, etc. So I think you got something else going on there. I think in this case you have, it isn't like David's having a bad hair day, like maybe he was, in the other one. He's just crabby and... But in this case, he's telling us something that's true about God. It's ugly in a certain sense from one perspective, but it's expression of God's holiness. Now, this isn't the whole story, because God doesn't just hate those who do wickedness. He also loves them, which sounds like a contradiction, but it's only a contradiction if you think that love and hate are emotions, and how can you have the emotion of love and hate simultaneously. Actually, I think married people understand that a little bit more. Where you can, I love you, but man, right now, To the moon, to... Alice. You know, that kind of thing.
Single people understand it, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, with people you love.
People who work with other people.
Right. I don't know which one she's thinking about. I don't know what she's talking about. And so I think that this then, it's an imprecatory psalm, but it is telling us something that true about God. And as far as the hermeneutics of it, we're just taking it face value. I think it is true that that God hates the wicked, and the only place of safety from a God who hates the wicked is under the shelter of the Son of God, Jesus mm-hmm. of Nazareth. So these things kind of fit together in odd ways, but we don't want to sanitize God in these verses. We don't want to say, oh, that's Psalm 5. That's just an imprecatory psalm, as if like, oh, that takes it away. Well, it's imprecatory, so well, let's tear that one out. He just was bugged a little bit when he wrote that, and he wasn't speaking the truth. No, he is speaking the truth, and it adds a dimension that's important to our understanding of God.
That's a good explanation.
Thank you.
I guess part of the reason, too, they make me uncomfortable is because I know I am a horrible, miserable sinner, and God's given me his grace.
You're right.
I know. So it sort of feels like instead of praying for God's righteous anger to be poured down on these enemies, I have to pray for grace because that's what I received. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think that fits into what you were saying. These psalms tell us something about God, mm-hmm. but at the same time, just as David did, God gives grace too.
Mm-hmm.
Next question comes from Jay Odermatt. Why did God not make Adam and Eve, Cain and Jesus, and get this all over with instead of billions of people going to hell? So like in a week and a half.
Yeah, it's like, well, different people are going to answer this different way. My basic answer, and someone raised a question similar to this last night at Marshall University, well, why didn't God do XYZ? And I said, I'll tell you, I don't know. Which is the answer that you give for most questions that start with the phrase, why didn't God do whatever XYZ? Why didn't he do it a different way than what he did? When you think about it, that's a question that could always be asked, even if God, you know, truncated the whole process right there into that, like what was suggested, then one could say, well, why did God make Cain and Abel? Wasn't it just bad enough that Adam and Eve sinned, then Jesus comes, and then it's over with? I mean, it just seems like no matter what it is that God does, someone could always ask, well, why didn't God do it differently? Well, I don't know why he didn't do it differently. That's his own mind, and he doesn't tell us about that kind of thing. Now, I do know, I have a suspicion how Bill Craig would answer this, and that has to do with, you know, possible worlds and kind of a modal logic and central, or rather, middle knowledge, and how God's desire is to maximize the number of people in heaven. And so it might turn out that given all the plausible worlds that God might create, that the one that the most people would actually be in heaven, and maybe the least in hell. I mean, I don't know. There's a balance there of actualizing the greatest benefit, all things considered, might have required tens of thousands of years of humanity and fallenness.
Yeah, but that's not your view, so you answer this.
No, I did. I don't know.
Okay.
I answered that. I said, I don't know. But I'm just suggesting that some have offered another thought, another way of thinking about it. And all I could say is that I would agree with Bill in the sense that God has a morally sufficient reason for doing what he does because
right.
he's a good God. And what Bill has done is he's tried to cast an example of what that reason might be from a perspective of somewhat, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but a creative, philosophical, theological twist. He's trying to solve problems, and I think that's a noble thing to do. I don't kind of go in that direction, but something like that is going to be the case. That is, God is going to have a morally adequate reason for making the world that he made with all that he knew would go to hell. I don't know what the reason is, but I'm confident that he has that.
Yeah, and I think it's related in the end to what most glorifies God. And it's not that sending people to hell glorifies God, but kind of related to the previous question in precatory psalms, God's justice as well as his love is a good thing, an objectively good thing. And yeah. For God to be able to display those things is a good thing.
Yeah, and so this is where I'd go back to your comment a moment ago when you said, well, it's not so much that what sending people to hell is going to glorify God. I think the only justification from God's perspective of doing so is that it does glorify him. It glorifies him.
It
demonstrates something good about his character. And it's not like he's this guy who needs to be stroked, and you got to say these nice things. So he really feels stroked when he fires up hell pretty hot and throws some people in, you know, like Jabba the Hutt, you know, or something like that. I saw that scene in the third Return of the Jedi. What was I watching? Well, on the airplane on this last trip, somebody was watching. I saw the scene. So, you know, that's not like God. But when God does justice by punishing someone in hell, solving, in a certain sense, the problem of evil, doing something about evil, when he does something about evil, that's a good thing. And the thing that he does that is good is he punishes evil people. And so because that's a good thing, then he is glorified. His glory is magnified by that good thing that he's doing.
Okay, just before we get to the last question, I just wanted to mention we've got two Rethink conferences coming up this fall. Our Rethink conferences are for students and youth groups. You can find more information at rethinkapologetics.com. And we also have our cruise coming up to Alaska in August. Cruise conference, Greg's teaching, J. Warner Wallace is teaching, and John Stone Street from the Colson Institute is teaching. Mm-hmm. And you can find information on our homepage, str.org.
Yeah, just in addition about the Rethink, parents are welcome. Youth leaders are welcome. So there are adults. It's a youth conference, but we've had a lot of adults come as part of their youth group or with their youth. Their parents have brought
kids.
And yeah, so we're not carding anybody when they come in, you know, if they're too old.
Well,
you don't have to.
We're the old people. so we've got Orange County in September. We've got Dallas in October and Alabama next spring.
In 2017.
Yes. That's next spring.
Yeah,
This is this spring. Back to another one
just
of our conversations.
Trying to be precise.
We've known each other a long time. We have these conversations over and over. Okay, last question, and you've got 2 minutes. Carlo 3999, what constitutes marriage in God's eyes? An act, an agreement, or a ceremony, or all three?
An act or an agreement? Or a ceremony, or all three.
Or two of the three.
Well, you know, I mean, the simplest characterization is when Jesus said, a man shall leave his father, and how does he put it? A man, Matthew 19, a man shall, I'll find it.
Leave his father and mother.
Is that what he says? Man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And what man, God has joined together, let no man put asunder. I think that's the best characterization of it. That's not a ceremony. It is a decision. What was the third one? A ceremony, decision, and what?
An act, an agreement, or a ceremony?
Well, I think it is both an act and agreement. That is the core of it, of the kind I just described, and because it's significant, so significant, and it is the core of our cultural heartbeat, so to speak, family, then having a celebration with the rest of the culture is understandable and fully appropriate. But you can still have the marriage without the celebration, because Adam and Eve didn't have any celebration.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not that kind of celebration. So yeah, I think it's partial. But nowadays, I'd say if people say, well, I'm just kind of, we're committed, so we're living together, but we didn't have our celebration, and we're not doing
it
before people.
We're married in our eyes.
Yeah, that I think is, you know, theoretically it can happen, but for the most part, I think that's a lot of baloney when people
do that. I think if we lived in a different culture, in a culture at another time, where people cohabiting...
On a desert island where there's nobody else around.
No, where people cohabiting was taken to be a marriage, and that in itself was the agreement. And, it, you know, but these days, people come together, they separate. So mm-hmm. that isn't enough. And for the longevity of marriages, as difficult as marriage is, I hear from people, the community support is important.
It's just, critical.
Right.
Right.
It's supposed to be hard to get out of.
Yeah.
And in the past, maybe it didn't take a contract and a ceremony to do that. But these days, mm-hmm. minimally it does. And even that's not that hard to get out
of
these days.
That's right. Yeah. You want every inducement and incentive possible to stay together. And when you make a public declaration before a community and you have a community around you, that means, or at least theoretically it means, that community is going to be supporting that marriage and going to be, and is going to be there to prod you forward when you don't want to go forward.
Mm-hmm. Great.
There you go.
All right. That's our second episode this week. STR Ask, short answers and a short podcast. It's possible. Greg has done it here. we post this STR Ask every Monday and Thursday. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kolka for Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.